Good afternoon. This is Chair Ruth Richardson, and pursuant to House Rule 10.1, I call this remote meeting of the Education Policy Committee to order. The clerk will take the roll for attendance.
Chair Richardson?
Present.
Vice Chair Hassan?
Present.
Representative Erickson?
Present.
Representative Drazkowski?
Present.
Representative Bennett?
Present.
Representative Berg?
Present.
Representative Bowe? Representative Bowe? Representative Christensen?
Present.
Representative Edelson?
Present.
Representative Feist?
Present.
Representative Frazier?
Present.
Representative Jordan?
Present.
Representative Keeler?
Present.
Representative Moeller?
Present.
Representative Mueller?
Present.
Representative Poston?
Present.
Representative Scott? Representative Scott? Representative Erdahl?
Present, and I congratulate Representative Poston for becoming a grandfather yesterday.
Thank you.
And Representative Wesolick? Representative Bowe? Representative Scott?
Here.
Madam Chair, a quorum is present.
Thank you, Ms. Larson. And I would also like to congratulate Representative Poston as well. I hope that it's a really happy time for all of you. Congratulations.
Absolutely. So, thank you.
We will move on to approval of the minutes. Representative Mueller, have you had an opportunity to review the February 17th, 2021 minutes?
I have, and I so move those, Chair. Thank you.
Thank you. Any discussion? All in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? The minutes are approved. So today, members, is the start of FFA week, and we want to welcome the students who are watching the live stream. Normally, they would be in the committee hearing room with us, and we are very pleased to have you joining us today. So we're going to get started with a presentation, and really also want to thank Representative Poston for his leadership around this issue as well as we are getting started. So Representative Poston, I will let you lead us off with some initial comments.
Thank you, Chair Richardson, and thank you for getting us fit into the schedule. Very appreciated. We all know, I think, that Minnesota agriculture is a huge part of our economy, and there are a lot of opportunities for young people in agriculture, not just at the farm, but in ag-related businesses. And I'm not going to say a whole lot more than that today, because I've got a group of testifiers that live, breathe, and work ag education every day, and they really are the experts. So I would like to let them go ahead with their presentation, Chair.
Thank you, Representative Poston. And I will just call individuals in the order that I have them listed here. We'll start with Commissioner Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tom Peterson. I serve as Commissioner of Agriculture, and I'm so pleased that you're taking some time today to National FFA Week to hear about agriculture education. And thank you, Representative Poston, for helping set this up, and congratulations to you as well. You know, at the Department of Agriculture, we're really proud to have one of our signature programs is our Minnesota Ag in the Classroom, which is a partnership between ag groups and teachers in the department that helps educate and bring ag literacy to kids from K to 12. And this is a program that's been around for more than 30 years. that is really thrived, I think, in COVID. And you look at how we adapt to different things. Just last week, we held a virtual book reading program where myself, the Lieutenant Governor, we had Minnesota Vikings read books to kids, and it was amazing, the kids that were online. And it was very simple as connecting that, you know, milk comes from a cow, eggs coming from a chicken, but beyond that too as well. And so I think that I really encourage, and you'll hear more about this in just a minute, but it's a really important piece, because a lot of times we ask about what are the things we're doing to help educate our kids about Minnesota's farms. You know, Minnesota is an agricultural powerhouse in the world and in the United States. You know, everything from our wheat farms in the valley, our corn and soybean fields in western Minnesota, our urban farms in the Twin Cities. We have a very diverse agriculture community, and our Ag in the Classroom really works hard to do that. I also served on the board of Ag in the Classroom before I was commissioner for many years. I'd also just like to really highlight the FFA and 4-H programs and how important they are to our youth K-12 in the state, and really providing opportunities for those youth to really learn. And a lot of times you think of FFA or 4-H as being you're going to be a farmer or a piece like that, but our farm, 68,000 farm families in Minnesota depend on many jobs and businesses and educations across the country. And a lot of that is learned through FFA and 4-H. Our hundreds of FFA chapters at schools across the state of Minnesota, and our many 4-H chapters around the state that we even have here in Pine City, where I'm calling in from my farm. My kids are in 4-H, it's an incredible opportunity. I wouldn't be in this position today, I'm very confident, if I hadn't have been a 4-H member. When I was 15 years old, I became secretary of the Chan Hostler's 4-H Club. And it led me to getting into parliamentary procedure and other things that gave me the opportunity to really thrive as I've come along in my career. So with that, you're going to hear from some excellent people and leaders that we have today in Sarah, and Keith. And so with that, I just appreciate having me today, and I look forward to working with all of you on Ag Education.
Thank you, Commissioner Peterson. Up next, we have Keith Olander, the Dean of Agriculture.
Chair, if I can interrupt for just a minute, I think we wanted to put Sarah Kushel next.
Okay.
And then Sarah Dornick next, and then Keith at the very end, please.
Okay, that is fine. Sarah,
thank you.
Please proceed.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Sarah Kushel, and I'm a regional curriculum specialist with Minnesota Agriculture in the Classroom. Agriculture literacy has played a part in my entire life, and the importance of that has led to my job today. Minnesota Agriculture in the Classroom is a unique public-private partnership between the Minnesota Department of Agriculture and the state's agricultural and educational communities, investing in the Minnesota Agriculture in the Classroom Foundation. This symbolic relationship brings curriculum, resources, and professional development to educators and students in every county of Minnesota. This curriculum is focused on agriculture and aligns with state academic standards for social studies, math, science, nutrition, and the language arts. Sparking a child's interest at a young age ensures they will be a lifelong learner. Allowing students to see themselves and their interests in our classrooms is more important than ever. Next. Minnesota Agriculture in the Classroom has been very intentional for over 35 years in helping students understand their connection to agriculture. The vision of Minnesota Agriculture in the Classroom is agriculture is valued by all. We truly believe this is true, as we are all connected through food. And it was proven as we saw grocery store shelves empty at times this past year, and families wondering where their next meal would come from. Agriculture literacy helps all students learn where their food comes from, how it is growing, and the importance of caring for our natural resources so we remain sustainable for years to come. Agriculture literacy, being part of our K-12 education system and beyond, ensures that each student has the opportunity to learn about our food system and the diversity of our state's agriculture as it stretches from the forests of northern Minnesota to the fields of the southern prairies in our state. Minnesota agriculture in the classroom experienced an impact growth of over 16,000 students, totaling over 143 students directly impacted in 2020. That is impressive. Demonstrating Minnesota agriculture resources and curriculum meets educator needs while cultivating an understanding and appreciation of the food and fiber system that we all rely on every day and can provide an engaging experience regardless of the education delivery platform. As I said, our resources are being used in all 87 counties, enhancing classrooms and virtual experience for our students, teachers, and even our families at home. As our team pivoted in 2020 to follow the education guidelines, we were able to offer a teacher tour of agriculture across Minnesota, allowing 103 participants from 40 different counties to be nose to nose with a bison, take a walk through a logging site, visit a school garden in St. Paul, and experience life as a beekeeper, and even more. Our resources are free to educators, offering a curriculum matrix of over 400 standard-based lesson plans, activities, and companion resources. Next slide, Sarah, please. Our flagship resource, the AgMag, now is available in both print and digital formats with an upgraded website and grade-specific issues highlighting all of Minnesota agriculture. In addition, we offer professional development training in person and now virtually, customized to each school district or team. We have focused our efforts on social media platforms to bring more opportunities to students across the state. Highlights have included touring many different kinds of Minnesota farms, from growing mushrooms in greenhouses to raising turkeys or visiting a Minnesota tree farm. Book readings with special guests such as Lieutenant Governor Flanagan, Commissioner Peterson, as well as 4-H and FFA leaders, and implementing Farm Fact Fridays to help all of us grow our agricultural knowledge. I am thankful I had many opportunities to participate in agriculture education as a student and grow my leadership skills and interests through FFA. In addition to my role as a curriculum specialist, I am also a mom and a proud beef rancher. Today, our family hosts tours of our beef cattle ranch, giving kids and other guests an opportunity to learn about beef, nutrition, care for our animals, land, and water. And above all, what a great place it is to raise a family. We also demonstrate the skills necessary to run a modern ranch, like mechanics, welding, math, precision agriculture, and drones. Having kids of my own, I have seen the value of programs that allow students to see themselves in the classroom and how that is preparing them for essential careers down the road. Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members, for allowing me to present today, and I'll now turn it over to Sarah Dornick.
Thank you, Ms. Kuchel. Ms. Dornick, please proceed.
Thank you, Chair Richardson. Members of the committee, my name is Sarah Dornick, and I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Agricultural Education Leadership Council, or MAILCE. MAILCE is a legislative council that was created to promote and expand agricultural education opportunities across the state. Thank you for having me here to present on the second part of our trio on school-based agriculture, food, and natural resources, or AFNR, education. I wanted to note that I use agriculture education and AFNR interchangeably throughout my remarks, so AFNR is the technical designation at the Department of Education. We were really pleased when Governor Walz and Lieutenant Governor Flanagan prioritized Career and Technical Education, or CTE, as part of the Minnesota Business Vitality Council. We know CTE concentrators, or students who have completed 250 hours of coursework, graduate at higher rates than non-CTE students. This is also true for students of color who are in CTE programs as compared to their counterparts in the non-CTE students. We truly believe CTE and AFNR is a great option to be the connection between the academic standards and the world of work for students. There are more than 1,000 secondary CTE programs that prepare more than 180,000 students each year for careers and opportunities in Minnesota's major workforce industries. AFNR is one of those areas and can be found in the top in that green area. Many times people make the assumption, as Commissioner Peterson referenced, that we are just training farmers. This is definitely important to AFNR and one of our priorities, but we are also working to meet the needs of all the areas of industry, including production, processing, transportation, marketing, sales, and doing so all while sustaining our state's natural resources. You can see on this graphic the pathways in which students can concentrate. Courses range from fisheries and wildlife, food chemistry, turf and landscape management, animal nutrition, aquaculture, ag mechanics, and much more. Power structure and technical systems is the most taught courses in our high schools, followed by animal science systems, of course. However, we continue to increase course enrollment in agribusiness, food science, and biotechnology to meet the workforce needs of Minnesota. We're able to prepare for these industry needs while also allowing students to take an AFNR course for science, economic, and art credit. To provide an overview, our AFNR programs are in over half the high schools in the state and serve over 35,000 students in grades 7-12, although the majority are in those grades 9-12. Approximately 20% of our AFNR students are students of color. As you can see from the map, the 200 programs are spread across the state and are taught by about 290 teachers. AFNR programming revolves around the three-component model found in that bottom corner that includes classroom instruction, work-based learning, which is a way for students to apply instruction and explore careers outside the classroom, and leadership development. We believe this model exposes students to the world around them and prepares them for any career, even if it's not in agriculture. In our case, leadership development is done through FFA, which is the Career and Technical Student Organization for AFNR programs. There are nearly 11,000 FFA members across the state, and as mentioned, it is FFA week right now. FFA makes a positive difference for students and builds them into leaders for their future communities. Although there are many challenges and opportunities listed on the slide, I'm just going to focus on a few of them. A priority for the state is to increase access for student participation. For this current school year, we did add 10 new programs across the state. And we've even started to hear new programs opening next year, including, I'm excited, Minneapolis Public Schools is offering coursework in the fall. Convincing a school to start a program is the biggest challenge I have. Without a program, students receive none of the benefits of our curriculum model. So getting that solid classroom is important. One area we're hoping to improve is our access to FFA programming. Currently, we are looking at ways to increase equitable access to the FFA through a change from a normal individual student dues structure to what we call affiliate membership. This is a due system that the school pays as one, and any student who takes an AFNR course is automatically a member and has access to all the opportunities that the FFA provides. Minnesota did receive a $275,000 USDA grant to pilot this type of membership structure this year in 24 of our schools. Another area of access is to ensure legislative language that is inclusive to allow flexibility for CTE programs at the local level to meet the standards and give students opportunities to take electives. If this is not done, students are unable to take our AFNR coursework, being an elective, and receive the benefits of CTE and FFA. Beyond just accessing programs, the diversity of Minnesota's students' population reinforces the importance for our teachers to develop skills to impact the students among them from all backgrounds. In the last 5 years, we've been providing targeted professional development for agriculture teachers to work effectively with diverse students in their programs. In a new effort this spring, MALSE, my organization, will be leading the process for developing a statewide Ag Ed for All plan to assess our state's diversity, inclusion, and equity practices throughout the various sectors of AFNR. Finally, one important thing I think for this group and all areas of education is our teacher shortage, which we have in education as well as in agriculture. We want to ensure we have enough quality educators in our classroom. We continue to have a shortage of ed teachers, although I will say we have increased the number of graduates. However, the number of programs and teaching positions in the state has exacerbated the shortage. For example, we've had nearly a 20% increase of agriculture teaching positions in the state over the past 5 years. I just can't keep up. Mielsey serves as the chair of our State Teach Ag Results, or STAR, committee that is implementing multiple comprehensive strategies to recruit and retain agriculture teachers in our classrooms. A few recruitment examples include a Teach Ag Ambassador program, a signing event similar to a sporting, you know, when students sign up that they're where they're going to school for sports, and a nominate a future agriculture teacher contest during National Teach Ag Day. My organization, Mielsey, has had a longstanding scholarship program to encourage students to study ag education. The scholarship program originally was developed for undergraduate students. However, we expanded in 2012 to include graduate levels, and then again in 2016 for diversity scholarships. Retaining students through that four-year degree has also been a challenge, and we've addressed this through a future agri-science teacher symposium, as well as a summer internship. I'm very proud that this year we had an 88% retention rate of those who taught last spring and entered in the classroom this fall, even during the global pandemic. Finally, for retention in the profession, we thank the legislature for the teacher loan forgiveness programs. In addition, we provide two mentorship programs, one for first-year teachers that has been in place since 1999, and a newer program for teachers in those years 2 through 10. Finally, we're working to help move our approximately 25 Tier 1 teachers through the licensure system in the hopes of keeping them in the profession. With that, I thank the chair and the committee for the time, and at the conclusion, I'm open to any questions you may have. At this point, I'm pleased to pass the microphone to our next phase of the AF&R pipeline to Keith Olander to speak about post-secondary.
And members, I see that there are some questions, and after Mr. Olander's presentation, we will move on to member questions. Mr. Olander, please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Richardson, members. My name is Keith Olander, Executive Director of AgCentric, Northern Center of Excellence for Minnesota State in Agricultural Education. Again, thank you for the opportunity. As we go forward, I want to share a little bit of how we work in the post-secondary world. Obviously, we want a seamless pathway when we think of our secondary partners, handing students over to the post-secondary world, but then beyond that, help them to become completers in their respective degree or certification, and then go on to industry for their desired career. We look at AF&R, and we like to use acronyms with this. Agriculture, Food, and Natural Resources, very comprehensive, but I compare it a little bit like a box of cereal. There isn't always the understanding of that process behind what the product is. And so, Sarah, if we look at the next slide, I think most of you can identify with the box there on the slide. Probably there's something you've purchased at the kitchen table. But the bottom line is, when we look at that, if I were to ask a great segment of the society, where does that come from? They're going to name their local store where they bought it online, right? But the bottom line is that that ultimately came out of some oats and cornfield, right, that came to that product and had to come through a number of different career areas. And of course, the box itself had to come right out of the forestry industry. And you look at all the different careers, and I'm certainly not listing them all, but it gives you a little bit of a broad scope of just one food product, how it comes out to be on our particular table, and where derivatives and all the people it touches along the way. So I kind of open that up and give you that concept of the expanse of AF&R. And then how do we work within the industry, getting talent for the industry and bringing them forward and making them mindful of these career opportunities when I think of parents, school counselors, or students in the, let's say, middle school or high school looking for a career successfully. So with that, Sarah, let's move on to the next one. Sarah mentioned these pathways, and I think for background, this is coming out of federal legislation, you know, that we outlined for career and technical education. And so we work with students secondary, post-secondary, and bring them into these pathways. One of the challenges we have in the post-secondary world is when companies come to broadcast jobs, they don't do that by pathway. And if we have students who are not familiar with agriculture, don't come from a farm background, this comes back to this access and equity. How do we get the language and the terminology common? And how do we get that between post-secondary world and the industry? And so while these career pathways do a nice job of assimilating all the different jobs and career opportunities, we're working with industry constantly to build connections and again level the playing field for access for all students. So let's go forward here, Sarah, and take a look at a few things. I'm going to share with you three different studies. I'm not going to go through the studies. I'm leaving you the links. And really what I'm going to drive home here is that I don't care what area of AF&R we're talking about, there is strong demand. I'll contrast this to my own personal experience. I graduated in 1990, coming out of the 1980s farm crisis. When I came out of that, there were very few opportunities in agriculture. My parents would have preferred had I not gone into agriculture. Very limited scope and growth. The industry was really suffering. Compare that now and fast forward to today's world. My son graduated high school last year, is completing his first year of college, came through FFA as I did, and he has a world of opportunities like I have never seen. And this particular study you see here on the federal level, there's about 60,000 jobs a year we're looking at going forward every year available at about a 2.6% growth rate. And again, you can see that by the NIFA study. The bottom line is that demand is going to exceed supply. Now, this is national. Sarah, if we step forward, I'm going to show you two Minnesota studies that will demonstrate the same thing. And that this idea, we've got about 388,000 jobs, right, that are in Minnesota. Somewhere around that 20% of jobs or one in five jobs handle food or fiber and help put it either on your back, build your house, or in this case, put food on the table is where we're going to focus our time on. But this is AgriGrow study, and I leave that link down there for you to study. But it has a major, major impact, as we certainly know agriculture in Minnesota ranks right at the top in terms of what it drives as we export commodities, not just to other states, but globally as well. And then we do that in value adds, as I mentioned, if we use the example of the Cheerios box. The other study, Sarah, if you'll step forward, is the Center for Rural Policy and Development. You probably are more familiar with that one. Again, I leave the link, but here again, the workforce shortages in AF&R is significant, not to a crisis level, but it is very concerning. It is at the 2.6% growth rate I showed on the first slide. You know, that's not a huge, tremendous growth, but the other thing we got to keep in mind is we have a tremendous amount of retirements coming out of the AF&R sector. And so you combine that with that growth, and we have huge, huge demand. So our work at the Centers of Excellence is how do we fill that pipeline? And so I really partner with like people like Sarah, and that we can get more schools to provide agriculture, food, and natural resource education and open the eyes of career influencers to drive them through post-secondary and out into industry. Mm-hmm. Let's step on forward, Sarah. Oops, back up. One area that the legislature has really helped and we appreciate so much is this workforce development scholarship. Agriculture is deemed as high wage, high demand, as are other the career sectors that you can see on the flyer there. We have worked specifically with the Centers of Excellence to grow this. We find that a number of even colleges don't always identify AF&R as one of the areas in which they have. And so we've really grown this literacy perspective. And you can see here these scholarships are important, and we've grown the number of uses within AF&R, and so we appreciate your support. Again, it comes back to this access and equity, leveling the playing field. These particular scholarships drive to two-year degrees, certificates, and diplomas, but can be transferable to four-year degrees or bachelor's at university level. Thank you for that support. If we look at this particular map, again, probably a little difficult to read, but the idea is if you just look at the graphics, if we focus in AF&R and we look to the eastern side of the state, we probably recognize more natural resources, forestry type degrees. And then as you move west, you probably see more of what you think of as farming or traditional agriculture, all of which is very important. The unique aspect in Minnesota State is most Minnesotans are within 50 to 60 miles of a campus or access to some sort of degree within that. And we continue just like they work at the secondary level. How do we have our 7-county metro area more available to AF&R on the secondary side? We want more degrees in the 7-county metro. There is no secret that the population base in this state is there and is critical for all of us as we want to draw some of that youth out to rural Minnesota. The other thing we all have to keep in mind too is that as a 7-county metro hub, there is a wealth of agriculture base here that we export globally. And there are very large companies that I think you're probably familiar with. So there's a tremendous amount of job demand just within the 7-county metro. Just a matter of how do we draw those connections between what the demand is and with the career influencers that are out there. So getting more specific, Sarah, on the next slide, how do we do this? And this is some of the ways I'd ask you to, you know, to give feedback or to challenge or to partner with us. But we really look at how do we catalyze the talent needs and helping students to understand that. We do that through a lot of literacy pieces, career fairs. We've gotten into virtual career tours with the COVID impacts and connecting high schools and colleges. You're very helpful on the scholarship side, and we appreciate that support. We want that to continue. This connecting with career influencers is one of our key areas of work, and career influencers obviously are the parents of that child. They're going to have probably the most significant impact, and that's no news to you, I'm sure. But how do we help parents understand that in agriculture, there is high demand and high compensation? And I'm not naive enough to know that if any other sector was sitting here in front of you, they would say the same thing. But I also am, in this idea that how do we deliver food and fiber out to our society, as we witnessed through COVID this last year, is very, very important. And so our job is, how do we get to career influencers, those parents, the school counselors, high school principals, in driving home this message, right? And then expanding the opportunities to more high schools around the state and colleges. The other side, as I talked about, in leveling the playing field in terms of access and equity, is this whole idea of the data collection practices in those career pathways and getting companies to think about posting and using those pathways terms. Because if students are not coming from a farm background and they get caught up in some, well, I'm in this pathway of plant science, but if the company isn't posting jobs, we see a disconnect that occurs there very quickly. And so we're looking and working constantly to drive home a common message as we go forward. I also invite you to visit our websites there, agcentric.org and centerofag.org. We have a lot of resources on there, including some of these studies I've shared. And as I bring this thing to a close here, if you'll step forward, things that are probably more prominent right now, these are perfect responses to industry. Poultry, as you know, if we go back to the avian influenza days, went through some significant challenges, but out of that born a new relationship between Minnesota State and the University of Minnesota. And this program is in its first year, but this is driving home both farm labor and middle management. That particular industry really has been working with us for a couple of years to try to solve that solution. We have not solved it yet, but we're in the process. Another one we all witnessed, just firsthand, was this access to fresh cut meats at our local grocery stores and what happened through COVID in the past months. So we're looking and working with folks like Commissioner Peterson. How do we diversify and open up opportunity for that and train more folks within that particular sector as well? And finally, another area, we've got two different grants going, one through National Science Foundation and another through the USDA. But this whole idea of technical applications or digital sensing system repair and maintenance, we think of that so much in IT, right? But in agriculture, so much that has become precision based, and we are severely lacking technicians who can resolve issues around the computers, driving most of the equipment that, of course, helps us in maintaining good, healthy environments and maximizes food production as we go forward. So those are some pieces of things that we're working on as we go forward. I thank you for the time today. I welcome any questions for any of us. These are the Centers of Excellence, and please check us out. As I wrap up my comment and my plea to you, if I can offer this, as we think about leveling the playing field, please keep agriculture education in the forefront of your minds. I know you have a lot of competition out there when it comes to high schools and what's elective and what's required. And as I came through high school, I appreciated that opportunity. I could get to that agriculture classroom and learn about some of that. And in today's society, as I look forward, as people become disconnected from their food source, I think it's more important now than ever that some of our curriculum is built into where does their food come from and how do we maintain that environment and at the same time keep our farms viable. So with that, Madam Chair, I will wrap up our comments and take questions.
Thank you, Mr. Olander, for your testimony. And members, I'll kick off the question and answer period here. I think this first question is for Ms. Dornick. You had mentioned that approximately 20% of the students that you are working with identify as students of color. Do you have a demographic breakdown of what that looks like disaggregated?
I do. I don't have it handy, but I can get it to you after. Oh, sorry, Chair Richardson, I apologize. Chair Richardson, I do have the breakdown and can get that to you.
Thank you. I would appreciate that. Next up, we have Representative Erdahl.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And first of all, I want to commend everyone involved in agriculture for the very important work they're doing. Basically, I just have a couple comments. We have some great FFA chapters in my district. Last Friday, I met with an FFA state officer from my hometown. Usually, we have a yearly session at Ridgewater College, which does an excellent job in working with farmers and students in the area. But I'm particularly interested in the excellence in integrating agriculture in the classroom awards. because if you can see this, this is from 1988, Excellence in Integrating Ag in the Classroom Awards, second place statewide for Dean Erdahl. And I'm sure the first prize was a very excellent award, but I got second place. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Erdahl. Next, Representative Keeler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, that's a hard act to follow, Rep. Erdahl. I have no accolades in my office for any of that. I did have a question, and I think it was for Ms. Dornick. You talked about teachers and how you're moving them from tier one to tier two. I feel like that conversation is happening in many different areas. I think you said 25 teachers. Is this your first like cohort that you're transitioning? Can you give some insight on what that's looking like and how successful you feel like that's going?
Ms. Dornick.
Chair Richardson, Representative Keeler. We are at the introductory level, so we are by no means an example. We are working, so in ag education, you have to cover both the content standards and you also have to cover the educational standards. And we're trying to find a way to partner both Minnesota State to offer some of those content standards. And then the U of M Twin Cities is the only place that has a graduate level ag education program. So our hope is to maybe more cost effectively take the content standards through the Minnesota State system. And also many of these teachers are already in the classroom. So we're looking to wait, could we do online virtual? Could we do kind of intensified summer sessions for them? And working in a group would be the best way to do that. And then they would then sign up to be at the U of M to finish the education pieces that they need to complete to get them through. And we're hoping to move them as a cohort. The hard part is at that level, they have each, you know, some came in with an animal science degree, so they don't need the animal science classes. Some came in with a food science background and they don't need those. So there's a lot of content areas to cover, but we're just in the beginning stages, but starting to group our stakeholders together to say who can offer what and make this happen.
Representative Keeler.
I love that. That's great. Keep us in the loop. I like I said, I know many different areas are looking how we can transition teachers through the tiered licensing. So any takeaways you have from that would be beneficial. I think we would like to hear that. I do have one follow-up question, Madam Chair, if that's okay.
Yes.
This one I think is for Mr. Olander. You talked just about the scholarship program and how we get people working in our agriculture field, and I am from the west side of the state, so we're really into farming, but I work in education and I also work in college and career readiness, and I know that there's this feeling or stigma around agriculture being very generationally or family focused, and so new kids who are interested in getting into farming, that's really a hard shoo-in. You know, it's like hard to go to a college career fair and say I want to be a farmer if you don't have the connection to the land. And so can you talk us through some of the engagement pieces for some of our other community members who might really be interested in getting involved? I know we have like community gardens, but we like on a much bigger level, because I know we talk a lot about plant to plate and how important that is within our own communities. So if you could touch a little bit on how we're opening that door for students who don't have the generational buy-in.
Mr. Olander.
Chair Richardson, Representative Keeler, thank you for the question. Certainly, as we look to, the average age of farmer right now, about 58, right? So it's concerning to all of us as to the next generation. And it is certainly true that in today, it's capital or asset heavy in a farm situation. So for new folks to come in, it is a challenge. I would offer up a couple of situations or circumstances in which we support that generational transfer or new people coming in. We have a program in Minnesota called Farm Business Management, and those faculty teach that very aspect of that business management. But more importantly, they'll meet with folks prior to wanting to get into farming, maybe up to 18 to 24 months, because they want to develop cash flow, business planning, right, goals, and teach a little bit around those aspects, because there are a lot of opportunities that are offered through the Minnesota Department of Ag in funding, as well as the Farm Service Agency. But if you have no background in that, it's really our faculty can help and educate in that process. So that's one caveat I would throw out there. The other side is we partner with the Department of Agriculture in FarmLink or programs like that, where we can try to identify people that want, they don't have people to hand the land down to. So how do we design a model that is equitable financially for those that want to leave the farm as well as those that want to take on the farm? We also are seeing, of course, a few models out there that are cooperative type farms. Those are yet to be determined as to how successful they'll be, but they're trying that. And where it is that we have multiple owners in those situations and trying to alleviate some of the capital stress or investment that comes with that going forward. And I guess the only other comment I would say right now is the current economics in agriculture this particular year in 2021, much different than the last seven. So building a what we would consider a profitable cash flow for this particular year is better than it's been in a long time. So we will see probably some generational transfer because we were seeing some of the transitions slow down because of the economics we have been so poor. So I'm hoping with those pieces that would satisfy an answer for you, Representative Keeler.
Representative Keeler.
Yeah, that was great. You said FarmLink.
Correct.
Mr. Olander.
Yeah, sorry, Chair Richardson. Yes, at the if you Google that or look at that, the Department of Agriculture, and I believe they're looking at doing some expansion on that as well. It's just a way to connect people who you are not by relation, blood, anything like that. They're not neighbors. They're just trying to connect. Hey, we're done or we want to exit farming in the next decade. And we want somebody to take this over. So we're trying to grow opportunities like that.
Representative Keeler.
Yeah, that was good. Thanks for bringing this to the committee. This was extremely helpful. Thanks, Representative Poston, for bringing all the great testifiers.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'd like to thank the presenters and members for the discussion. Having been a past FFA member myself, as a matter of fact, a state FFA officer in Wisconsin when I was a Ute, I can tell you the meaning that it has to me and the impact that I know it's not only had on myself, but many, many rural and not so much just rural today, families and the students when they go through the program. The leadership opportunities that the FFA offers are immense, unlike any others that I have seen. And I think it's really something that even some of our more urban schools could figure out how to emulate. It would help them as and many of their students as well. I'm especially enamored by the discussion, having been a county extension ag agent for 15 years of my earlier life, with the ag in the classroom stuff that the other Sarah, not Sarah Dornick, but the other Sarah talked about here. So I appreciated really hearing that and have seen an amazing advance in that effort since the last time I stuck my head into the discussion, which was maybe 5 years ago or so. So great work. You guys are doing doing a great job because it's so important for us in the rural and metro areas to understand each other because the fact is the food, the cornflakes or the hamburger don't come from country store. But if the metro people, when they're young, don't have that connection and understanding of it early, they don't get to know that. And it can affect public policy as they get to be adults and decision makers and voters as well. So just like to thank you again for your presentation. Great work.
Representative Poston, any final words?
Thank you, Chair Richardson. I'll just real quickly, I think the testifiers have done a great job showing how important agriculture is to Minnesota, how important ag education is, and how many wonderful, meaningful careers are out there tied to this industry. So I'd like to thank them for their presentation and for what they do every day. And again, I'd like to thank you, Chair, for fitting us into the schedule. Very appreciated. Thank you.
Thank you again, Representative Poston, for your leadership on this. And thank you to all the testifiers today. And also thank you, Ms. Dornick, for being willing to get the demographic information sent over when you can as well. With that, we will move on to House File 562. Representative Erdahl, would you like to move your bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will move my bill. Is this for possible inclusion? Is that what what we're looking at here?
Yes, it'll be laid over for possible inclusion, correct.
Say likely inclusion, is that what you said? Oh, possible. I always get that mixed up.
There you go. All right. Thank you, Representative Erdahl. And would you like to proceed to your bill?
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. And first of all, this has been an effort that I have been engaged in I don't know, 4 or 5 years now, trying to get this. And we've come close. I think it's particularly important this year in light of being on the Select Committee of Racial Justice and all the basic elements of this bill were recommended as one of the proposals from that committee as well. So thank you for that, Representative Richardson. So civics is in a state of crisis. Former Supreme Court Justice Sandra Day O'Connor stated, "We are facing a crisis in civics education." The National College Board reports that the most important skills correlated with success in college are computer science and the United States Constitution. Surveys that I've seen show that 77% of Americans between 18 and 34 can't name even one of their U.S. senators. Two-thirds of Americans can name at least one judge on American Idol. 15% can name the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. Two-thirds of Americans can name only one branch of our government, and one-third can't name any. The National Association of Education Progress, NAEP, which is called the nation's report card, reported that third graders show progress in civics knowledge, eighth grade knowledge level flatlines, and civics in Minnesota, when it's taught, is mostly taught in ninth grade. Seniors graduate with a proficiency rate of about 23%. So over about 77% of the students who graduate from our high schools are failing today in knowledge of civics. And that's what this has all been about for me, to try to raise the relevance of civics to improve the attainment of knowledge. So why do we have these problems? First, the focus on STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math is very important. And it needs to be taught, but as it's taught, something else has to give. And this has largely pushed out civics and history. The Civics Now Coalition reports that in federal spending, $54 a student a year is given to STEM education and 5 cents per student per year for social studies. Now, local school boards, face challenges in balancing the curricula that they have, the demand for these STEM courses, the demand for other electives. And so those are challenges that they face in putting in or emphasizing others. Nordic educators work hard to cultivate each student's connection to their nation, and we largely fail to identify national terms. When taught effectively, students can equip students with the knowledge and dispositions necessary to become informed and engaged citizens. Former Senator Larry Pressler, now a college professor, commented about high school civics. They're not learning it there. It isn't being taught. In Minnesota, we require 3.5 credits of social studies, encompassing at least United States history, geography, government, and citizenship, world history, and economics, sufficient to satisfy all of the academic standards in social studies. There is no assigned credit requirement to teach civics in Minnesota. Civics is supposed to be taught, but we can't guarantee it. And in fact, in some areas, it's not being taught. So, page stuck together. What this bill does, it requires civics to be credit bearing within the 3.5 current credits. I'm not trying to assign that there has to be one credit in civics or half a credit or a quarter credit. That's up to local school boards. But what I'm saying is that it needs to be credit bearing. It also needs to be taught to juniors or seniors. These are obviously the older students in our school who are ready to learn. They're ready to be voters. In ninth grade, they're not caring about the three branches of government. They're not caring about what's going on in the world of politics, because they're years removed from it. It doesn't mean a lot to them. But juniors and seniors are ready to take that next step and to become participating members of our society in terms of voting. Now, there have been various concerns, and I have worked over the years with the School Board Association and other groups trying to formulate a plan that can be acceptable and can work for all concerned. There were at one time concerns expressed about electives. Can we still teach the electives? Can we do what we need to do and meet the things that the students want? So what I did is, and here there's a little mistake, Madam Chair. I had a couple of bills that are quite similar, and there is some language that needs to be inserted in this bill. I can easily do that when it's being laid over. What it does is it puts in advanced placement, international baccalaureate, or other rigorous courses on government or citizenship in addition to the course being offered. In other words, the concern about electives, the concern about not being able to do baccalaureate classes, not being able to do these other things, is addressed by this amendment, which says that they can take the place of a civics course if they have some type of government component. And I talked with Ms. Pera about that, and the amendment is already drawn. So we can get that. So one other comment. This is from an 1828 textbook. Remember that a constitution which gives to the people so much freedom and entrusts them with so much power rests for its permanency on their knowledge and virtue. An ignorant people are easily betrayed, and a wicked people can never be ruled by the mild influence of their own laws. From an 1828 textbook. You have received from School Board Association and Metropolitan School Districts a letter. I have met with them about that, and I think that we are within range of reaching some agreements to accommodate the concerns of that they have and concerns that I have in getting a good bill that can be supported, well, I can't say universally, but largely. So again, that letter that you have, I have addressed. And we'll continue to. The particular part they have in there on economics or personal finance, that's one change in the bill, that a student can receive credit for taking economics or personal finance. Now, this is needed. Our students need to do a better job, I think, of preparing for the future and understanding their personal finance. But if it doesn't fit in here particularly, where there are concerns about how to make this work better, I'm willing to work with various groups to reach that goal so that we can get this important provision included somewhere. So that basically is the bill. It's why we need to do the bill. And I do have some testifiers that would like to amplify a little bit.
Thank you, Representative Erdahl, for that. I've got three testifiers on the list here. Do you have a preference to the order that they're called?
I do not.
Okay. Thank you. First on the list, I have the president of the Litchfield School Board, Daron Anderson.
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Daron Anderson. I actually wear two hats. I'm the chairman of the Litchfield School Board, and I'm also a teacher in the Wilmer Public Schools. So I would echo a lot of what Representative Erdahl has said. Civics is really important. Our students need to learn civics, especially this past year. The problem that Representative Erdahl pointed out is that most civics is taught in ninth grade, and I, as a teacher, have seen a lot of kids in ninth grade. This isn't going to impact me. It doesn't affect me. And so they don't really learn, they don't really want to take into account. But this past election really amplified why it's important for students to understand. I teach American history, and I had kids coming in every day asking about the 2020 election, about, I mean, think about it too, when is the last time we've seen the Electoral College get as much publicity and students asking about it? So to understand the process, students want to know. I went as far as integrating civics into my American history classroom by printing out an article about an issue that one of the candidates was looking at, and we would read it. We'd talk about it, how it impacted them. So students want to know. They want to learn. As a school board member in Litchfield, we passed a resolution as a school board supporting Representative Erdahl's bill of teaching civics in the classroom. Also, too, Litchfield is doing this. We offer American government for juniors and seniors with that civics component, and they still have over 40 electives that they can take. So this is very doable. So civics is very important. We need to teach these kids how to register to vote, how a bill becomes a law. My students right now are watching me do this and looking at the process. As juniors and seniors, they want to know. They're engaged. So it's very important to teach it at this level. Secretary of State Steve Simon, the last 2 years or last 4 years, has presented Minnesota Votes. We need to promote civics now, not every time there's election. So teaching these kids civics is very important. And I would like to see this bill passed to engage our students, to educate them, because we want more participants and more voters. Here's our opportunity to do it. Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members.
Thank you for your testimony. Up next, I have Judge Michael Thompson from the 8th Judicial District.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. I've known Mr. Erdahl for many, many years, and we've had conversations about this. My experience by sitting on the bench included a number of items, but the most important one was that most people that come into the judicial branch really have no idea what we're supposed to be doing, what our mission is, and how it works. Their information has been gleaned from television programs that they've watched, beginning with the old Perry Mason series years and years ago, where they're always expecting somebody to stand up and admit that they did it at the end of the program, which doesn't happen. But it was also, I gleaned that a lot of our people do not understand our Constitution. They've never had any class where they actually had to take the time to read the Constitution. And so you hear folks always saying, well, that's got to be unconstitutional. That can't be right. And yet they have not, they don't know what they're talking about because they never even read it. They need some exposure to this. I taught a class one time where I actually brought in a bunch of the amendments, and the one that got the most reaction from the females in the class was showing them when they were granted the right to vote. They've been taking it for granted for years, and they had no clue that they couldn't vote back in the 1800s. So, if you can train these folks and give them some background on how our system works, I think they become a lot more, I think it's easier for them then when they run into conflict to be able to see how the system is supposed to work and try and follow that path and treat the different branches of government the way and have an understanding of how they work, and then don't get so upset when they don't think it's working the way it's supposed to, because now they have a basis to say, well, it is supposed to work this way. Let's let it work this way. And then we will accept the results. But right now we have a lot of folks who won't even accept the results because they don't think it was done properly, but they really don't know how it was supposed to be done in the first place. So that's what I've been trying to support on this. I know we have all these different areas that people want to be educated in, but a citizenry that doesn't understand how their government works essentially is leading us to lose that type of government, because they go all off in different directions. And I think they, as we saw just in the last year, we've had a terrible split amongst people, families breaking up over issues. And in large part, it was issues that if they had some knowledge about how our system works, the three parties of government, that maybe those terrible discussions and wouldn't have happened. So I support this a lot. I think we need to let our young people know that there are three parts of government, what each part of government is responsible for, and how you go about accessing each one of those. And I think that would be really helpful. So that's my comments on that. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Judge Thompson, for your testimony. Up next, we have Lisa Larson with the Minnesota League of Women Voters.
Good afternoon. My name is Lisa Larson, and I'm here on behalf of the League of Women Voters, Minnesota, to support Representative Erdahl's bill, House File 562. Improving civics education is a great concern of the League of Women Voters, Minnesota. League members think a good civics education gives students the knowledge and skills they need to effectively participate in civic life and helps prepare students for their roles as citizens. House File 562 requires students at a minimum to take a civics course in 11th or 12th grade when they are close to becoming first-time voters. For these almost voters, civics is immediate and real. Learning about voting and engaging with public officials should be a personally meaningful experience. I wish to briefly raise 4 points. 1, civics education is critical to strengthening American democracy. The founding fathers saw education as the way to safeguard America's system of self-government and help voters choose their leaders wisely. 2, a long-standing tension exists in schools between educating students to be skilled workers and responsible citizens. Both goals are important and must work in tandem. Schools today emphasize preparing students for work and higher education much more than they emphasize preparing students to be engaged and effective citizens. As Representative Erdahl noted, many high school students are not proficient in civics. In 2014, only 23% of students achieved a score of proficient or above on the NAEP civics test. There was no significant change in the 2018 average NAEP civics scores. 3, civics is not consistent statewide. It varies as to whether civics is a separate course or the civics content standards are embedded in another social studies course. And it varies in what grade 9 to 12 students receive civics instruction. Students who take civics in ninth grade may never take another civics related course in high school. 4, civics literacy is key to transforming knowledge into practice. A good civics education emphasizes the importance of project-based learning and fosters a culture of civic engagement and community problem solving. Civics is not synonymous with history. Civics gives students the ability to apply the knowledge and skill sets they learn in history. A high quality civics education lets students engage in model democratic processes, participate in the civic life of their communities, and learn from practical experiences. To conclude, a civics education is important because it profoundly affects the role of citizens and citizens' ability to participate in a democracy. Improving civics education should have nonpartisan support across the political spectrum. Strengthening American democracy is an interest we should all share in common. Please support House File 562. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Larson, for your testimony. In regards to public testimony, we currently have one public member signed up, Justin Whitrock.
Yes, thank you very much for this opportunity. I appreciate it. Good afternoon. My name is Justin Whitrock. I'm a business teacher at Litchfield High School, and I represent over 150 business teachers as the president of the Minnesota Marketing, Business, and Information Technology Educators Association. I'm going to speak to the language about the personal finance and economics component. The language in this bill says that students can take econ or personal finance. When we've had personal finance bills try and come up as a requirement, administrators have had a problem with adding an additional requirement to it, similar to the civics issue. But with this one, it gives students the opportunity to choose what is best for them. because it allows students a choice in taking personal finance instead of economics. The economic standards include many micro and macro economics concepts that do not pertain to all students the same way, that getting an in-depth training and knowledge of loans, credit cards, budgeting, insurance, taxes, and et cetera does. In the current econ standards, personal finance is part of only 4 out of 34 substrands. So when we hear people say that personal finance is covered in econ, it's not covered well enough. In the newly proposed social studies standards, in the econ section, personal finance is only part of 19 out of the 93 benchmarks. So even as we update it, the newly updated ones, it still doesn't have enough in it. So an economics class does not provide enough personal finance, especially if you are not raised in a home where good personal finance strategies are discussed or even practiced. And that's where, if students don't get this in high school, where are they going to get it? Right now, there's students that they are taking, because they have to take econ, they also take personal finance, which then limits their ability to take other classes as well. In many districts, personal finance is taught by the career and technical educators, that's business facts or ag. These teachers develop, as part of their licensure programs, content, knowledge, and skills for delivering personal finance, so there wouldn't be any need for additional training in this addition to make the graduation requirements. There are also significant personal finance benchmarks and standards already written into CTE subject areas at both the state and national level, so developing the standards wouldn't be an overwhelming task either. Also, the ability for personal finance to be taught as an alternative to economics could also allow districts the potential to access Perkins Fund Levy dollars when CTE teachers are the ones teaching it. So if the personal finance is being taught by a CTE teacher, which again is business, facts, or ag, schools can access the Perkins Fund Levy dollars, which would pay up to 35% of a teacher's salary. Okay, so there is some sort of economic benefit to districts as well. Students are currently required to take an economics class, but because of scheduling limitations, they're unable to take personal finance. So they're not always given that opportunity. But there are students on a university track that would benefit from taking economics, so they can still take that class and get some personal finance content. Other students would benefit most from taking a full comprehensive personal finance class, so these students can choose this option. This gives students, it gives teachers, and it gives the administrators a lot of flexibility in trying to provide students with an education in personal finance, which is a significant issue within our state and national economy. And with that, I appreciate the time. And if anybody has any questions, I would be happy to answer them.
Thank you for your testimony. At this time, is there anyone else logged into the Zoom who wishes to speak for or against this bill? Please use the raise hand feature. Okay, seeing none, we will move on to member questions. Representative Jordan.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Erdahl, for bringing this bill. We went through that amendment very quickly. Is it possible, Representative Erdahl, for you to go through that amendment again, or perhaps Ms. Parra right. walk through the amendment?
Yes, I could.
Representative Erdahl.
Madam Chair. All right, I'm on my other screen. I'll read what it would be to you. Okay, moves to amend House File 562 as follows. Page 1, line 21, after later, insert, or an advanced placement, international baccalaureate, or other rigorous course on government and citizenship under section 120B.021, subdivision 1A.
Representative Jordan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't have any questions with this.
Let me add that amendment largely has met the concerns that school administrators and the school boards had.
Thank you.
Representative Moeller.
Thanks, Madam Chair, and thanks, Representative Erdahl, for bringing this bill and for your passion surrounding this issue. I had a question about something that was raised in one of the letters we got regarding the test that's given. And I think some of the testifiers spoke to at least the national statistics on how poorly students do on that civics test. And I think one of the recommendations from the letter was that the state not require that test anymore. And I was just curious what your thoughts were about that. And then also, I was just curious to know how it's administered now. Do most teachers give that as part of the course, or how that works?
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Moeller, first, the test referenced earlier with the low proficiency rate, that's not the one that you are referring to. The test that is given in Minnesota and in many areas across the country is based on the naturalization citizenship test. For example, Wisconsin gives it, they have to pass it to graduate from high school, and that's in a lot of states. In Minnesota, it's a 50 question test, again, based on the immigration test. It is aligned with our current social studies standards and reviewed by Learning Law and Democracy, which is a civics teacher organization. And they have to pass 30 of those 50 questions. And my assumption is that most of them are doing quite well. However, we do not have a reporting requirement in the state of Minnesota. All students are supposed to take the test before they graduate, but there is no requirement that they have to pass the test, no requirement that the test is reported anywhere beyond the classroom teacher. In terms of the future of the test, it is currently a required test in the state of Minnesota. As we go through the process, it will be subject to more of the discussion as we try to reach an amicable agreement on getting the civics moving.
Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm just curious if we know how teachers feel about that test. You know, maybe don't have a correct sample size here, but maybe the teachers that are on here, Mr. Anderson, maybe if you would speak to how you offer that test to students, I'd be curious to know about that.
Mr. Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Mueller. In the summer, I teach at a juvenile detention center, so I have year-round school. So I do teach a big civics component, and then I administer the test. Some of it's taken from the naturalization test. Some are the questions that are based on things that we covered in class. So I give them the test. It's a 50-point test. I give it at one time. And then I take their scores, and then I send them to our director, who puts them on their transcript, so that if when the student goes to another school, it follows them and says, hey, they took the civics test. It's not turned into the state, but it's showing that they've taken it and if they've passed it. If they have not, I give the student an opportunity to retake the test.
Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That's all.
Vice Chair Hassan.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Rep. Erdahl, for this. I know your passion for civics, so I won't ask too many questions. I just want to mention, so as an immigrant, many of you guys know, I came here to this country as an immigrant, and I had to take that civic test, and it's 100 questions. And immigrants are required to know how to read and write and pass that civics test. And I remember in my first year of college, was right after I took my citizenship test and became a citizen. I was taking political science class, and the professor decided to just throw that test to the students. And I was the only student that passed that test, and only because I just took my citizenship test, not because I've learned any other questions from our schools. But my question for you, Rep, is, as you know, there's a lot of, you know, we are at a point, I would say, a racial awakening in our country, and many people are talking about ethnic studies. Would you support ethnic studies to be included in our social studies? Because, I mean, I was educated in this country, and I had to actively take ethnic studies in college and pay for it in order for me to get maybe a glimpse of what happened in our country as far as people who are non-whites go. All I knew was that the people that look like me, the only contribution that they had in our country was that they were enslaved and they fought for their freedom and that was it. And we know that's inaccurate. The same goes for our indigenous communities and all the other non-whites. So would you support and advocate for ethnic studies to be included in our social studies?
Representative Erdahl.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Fazan. Let me answer that last. Another quick comment first on Representative Mueller. First of all, these, even if we didn't have this test, those questions should be asked. I mean, we are supposed to be teaching civics, and there should be a civics test, whether it's mandated by the state or not. So I'm assuming that a lot of these questions should be asked anyway. Regarding Representative Hassan, yes, I mean, I think that we need to do a better job in ethnic education in Minnesota, especially, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, that ethnic studies includes the study of the culture of people. And we have a diversified country. It's becoming more diversified. And it is important to understand and study the cultures, and I guess then that would be ethnicity of all the diverse groups. Does that answer your question? And do we tie culture and ethnicity together?
Vice Chair Hassan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, but what I'm trying to echo in my comment and my question is that our education is Eurocentric view of the world. It's not, it doesn't highlight any other cultures. It doesn't highlight any other people. It highlights our students learn everything that happened in Europe, but we don't learn anything else in the world. So like my question is just like, you know, refocusing on are we gonna teach our kids about the rest of the world and the rest of the people that are in the world with us? And we're living in a global village. You know, in 1960s, it was okay to it was never okay, but it was more normalized to teach people that, you know, there are only white people in the world, the rest of the people are non-existent. But today we're living in a global village. So, you know, mainstream kids are missing out if they would never find out that, you know, the contribution of African Americans and Asian Americans and Latino Americans, as well as our indigenous communities and everyone else. So that's where I'm trying to highlight is that I wish your bill had that, like ethnic studies included in it, and I would be super excited about it. But that's why I asked the question. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Rudolph, do you have a comment?
Sure, thank you, Madam Chair. Well, combining into this with I got to stick to what I'm trying to get done over these last few years. Now, that doesn't mean that with the standards under review right now, that Representative Hassan, what you are talking about, should not be an important part of that discussion. And so I think that a lot of the concerns that you have are going to be addressed when we reach the end of the road on the standards.
Thank you, Representative Erdahl. Vice Chair Hassan, anything else?
No, ma'am. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Jordan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Representative Erdahl, again, for this discussion. I actually grew up in a state where it had a law where this is pretty similar. And I really remember the thing I remember from it is even though I was a good student and kind of a government nerd, which probably shouldn't come as a surprise, I'm sure a lot of people on this call were, I remember that test being extremely stressful. And I took it when I was in ninth grade and I was very worried that I would fail it and not be able to graduate from high school. And as a result, I remember the grade I got on two tests in my entire life, and it was the Illinois Civics exam or the Illinois Constitution exam and the ACT. Can you talk to me a little bit about how students feel about this exam? I know we've heard a lot of testimony about how students are very stressed out about school and mental health right now, and I wouldn't want to burden them with another thing to stress them out. So can you talk to me a little bit about how students feel about this requirement? But I also think there's a lot that students really welcome here too. So I don't know what insight you have there.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Jordan. Say, Representative Jordan, you want to tell us what your score was on your test? You don't have to.
Representative Jordan.
Yes, I'm very proud to tell you my score on this test because I got a perfect score, Representative Bertal.
Right, Representative Bertal.
Very good. And that's really, I mean, when I have asked, like I called into Milwaukee at the three urban inner city schools, and all of the schools had an average score in the 90s. You know, students were doing very well. In terms of in Minnesota, I have not received complaints from students. Basically, when I was proposing to do this in the first place, students were saying, no, we don't want it. Because, well, obviously, if you're a student and I say, I want to give you another test, you're not going to be welcoming. But the fact is that they do have to take this test in Minnesota, but essentially there's no pressure. They don't have to pass the test to graduate as it is in some states. It should be they're taking the test. And when I taught, my tests were part of my learning process. And I would hope that by taking the test, it is helping them to learn because this is important to know. And, they can also keep taking it until they pass it, if that's the teacher's prerogative, and not a lot of pressure. You know, I've likened it to athletics. If my team is down by 1 point and I get fouled taking a shot at the buzzer, so I've got two free throws, that's pressure. But if I'm taking a test and if I flunk it, I can still take it again. And again, until passing, there's not a whole lot of pressure. So I don't think that the test is a big aggravation to our students in Minnesota.
Representative Jordan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Representative Bertal. I think, legislators probably, we all really care quite a bit about civics and making sure that we have students that understand the processes that we go through. So please keep going at this, and I'm sure we'll figure something out.
Thank you. And Madam Chair, maybe we should give the test to all the legislators and publish their scores.
Well, I will let all of the members determine if they're willing to be as free with their scores as Representative Jordan is. Representative Christensen. You are on mute, Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thanks to both the Rep Poston and Rep Erdahl. Rep Erdahl, I especially like, so I hope it gets to stay in the bill. I like your personal finance inclusion in there. I think it's so important. And I think there's way too many young people. I've got an 18-year-old grandson who is, they don't get it. They don't get it, you know. What it takes to really to manage your own finances in this world. So I want to thank you for including that, and I certainly hope it can move on. And Representative Poston, thank you so much for introducing this. I know I'm from, it's called the suburbs now, but in my school district in Stillwater, our ag department is very, very popular. And it's not just amongst people that want to farm. You know, they're learning how to grow prairie plants and how to plant prairies. They're having plant sales. They're having, there's much to be included in those programs. So thank you both of you for bringing these bills up. Thanks much.
Thank you, Representative Christensen. Representative Erdahl, I will give you last words on your bill.
Well, thank you very much. I do appreciate the discussion. Again, congratulations to Representative Jordan and Representative Hassan for doing so well on the test. But unfortunately, as we have indicated, scores in Minnesota, NAEP scores show that Minnesotans are not doing very well when they graduate from high school in terms of proficiency. And so for the future, as these scores indicated, as current events indicate, we need to do something better. And what we are doing right now for civics education in Minnesota is not working for all students. And that's the purpose of this and why I'm asking that it move forward and we get it done this year. So thank you, Representative Richardson.
Thank you, Representative Erdahl. So House File 562 is laid over for possible inclusion, and there being no further business before the committee, we are adjourned.